Fred Thompson and Hillary Clinton have something else in common besides Senate service and White House ambitions. They both came to Washington because of Watergate. He was minority counsel to the Senate Watergate Committee. She was a young lawyer who worked for the House Judiciary Committee, which handled the impeachment of President Richard Nixon. Next month, it will be 35 years since our nation's most famous burglars were caught inside Democratic National Committee offices. Almost half of all Americans alive today were not yet born. So while it still may reverberate in our politics, the presidency of Richard Nixon is now, for most people in this country, part of an inherited experience, not a personal one. It's a part of history. Elizabeth Drew, who covered Watergate as a journalist, revisits that history in her concise new biography of Nixon for the American President series. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Robert. Glad to be here.
One of the questions you address about Nixon in your book is whether the Watergate break-in and the threat of scandals that it unveiled was some anomalous moment in the presidency that we might otherwise remember for the breakthrough with China or detente with Moscow. And you say no, it was somehow essential to Richard Nixon that there would be a Watergate break-in or something like it.
The mentality that Nixon brought to the White House of being a highly suspicious, even paranoid man who was bent on getting even with or even destroying his enemies began in the first month. In itself, it was the fourth attempt to get into that building, and they'd already raided the files of the psychiatrist of Daniel Ellsberg.
The man who had leaked the Pentagon
papers. Now, it was a shocker at the time, but think about this. A person has a doctor, a psychiatrist, the most private relationship, and the White House hires these people to go in and get your files. I mean, this is against the Fourth Amendment, but it's also an incredibly alarming mentality that would do this. Robert, I don't throw terms around loosely, as I think you know, and I could only conclude that this systematic effort to undermine the opposition party was a step on the way to fascism. This is the first thing you do.
One newer dimension to the portrait that you present of Richard Nixon, in degree at least, concerns his drinking, the extent of it, and also sometimes his use of drugs.
He not only drank excessively from all of the evidence to a point where he was out of control, often. Nixon was drunk on the eve of the invasion of Cambodia, and probably the evidence is for a few nights before that. Now, as you know, if you're drunk, you don't always make such clear-headed decisions. He showed the symptoms by slurring his words, mood swings. On top of that, he self-medicated a drug called Dilantin, which had been urged on him by the financier Jack Dreyfus. Dilantin is an anticonvulsive drug. It has never been prescribed as a mood alterer, but Dreyfus thought that this had really helped him through a bad depression, and so Nixon said, get me some. So the effect of taking Dilantin multiplies the effect of drinking. They have the same kinds of mental confusion, slurring words, not sort of even knowing what you're saying.
And the way you describe it, his staffers understood that there would be some evenings or some days when he would give out orders that you understood were more about the drink and the temper than any reasoned decision, and some orders they knew to disregard.
Well, not everybody knew which ones to disregard. Chuck Colson, his henchman, would not have dreamed of disregarding an order from the president. You know, isn't that scary? I came to the conclusion, Robert, I started with thinking he's an improbable president because he didn't like people. He was almost incapable of small talk. By the time I got to the end, the evidence led me to the conclusion that this man was not fit for the office. He was too tormented. He was too bent on vengeance. He did not understand the limits of the presidency, that you do not use the instruments of government against your personal or perceived enemies.
As for his state of mind, I'd just like to read something you write describing his behavior. You write in the book, Most evenings when Nixon was in Washington, he sat alone in the Lincoln sitting room in the White House residence, air conditioning on high, a fire blazing in the fireplace, listening to the soundtrack of the television documentary Victory at Sea. And then you write, during the days, he would sit writing notes to himself on a yellow legal pad with instructions to himself. Add element of lift to each appearance, he wrote one day. Lift spirit of people, pithy, memorable phrases.
He was obsessed with his own image. And you'll see elsewhere in the book, he writes instructions for his aides to say that he is an able and kind administrator. He's imaginative. It goes on and on. He keeps making these lists of what he wants his aides to portray him as. He did this with Henry Kissinger after their trip to China. He was obsessed with his image.
You entertain at least the argument, which I've heard elsewhere, that Richard Nixon, if you compare him certainly to subsequent presidents, was, by what he did in some respects, a rather liberal president. And some people cite, say, his embrace of environmental protection as a federal responsibility. You say no. When he did such things, he was only accommodating other forces. This wasn't what he was all about.
Nixon described himself as a pragmatist. He has gotten a lot of post-mortem credit for a fairly progressive domestic record. He did a lot of this resisting. On the environment, he realized the environmental movement was coming to its peak, so Nixon commissioned a poll and found that public interest in the environment was at an all-time high. So he proposed programs. Almost all of them had already been proposed on Capitol Hill. And he did accept the premises of a lot of this legislation, but he tried to cut funds and he did use some vetoes. It did happen under him, but I think to say it happened because of him is a little bit of a shallow analysis.
Having gone back to revisit this character who dominated certainly the lives of journalists around Washington back in the 60s and 70s.
Dominated my life growing up in Cincinnati.
What did you find that was new, looking back on it now? What change is there in your view of Richard Nixon, if any?
I did not understand before the degree to which he was a tormented man. I did not see the complete picture of the effects of his literal paranoia. He meets the definition of a paranoid personality in the psychiatric manuals. And that means, among other things, not just that you see all these enemies who don't exist, but you don't always make considered decisions. I ended up feeling that I was in his head, mm-hmm. that I understood him. He's been this great mystery to us. He's been so considered so complex and unfathomable. I felt I understood him. I understood the torment that he was going through virtually all of his life. And I ended up with some empathy for the man.
Well, Elizabeth Drew, thank you very much for talking with
us. You're welcome. I loved it.
Journalist Elizabeth Drew talking with us about her latest book, Richard M. Nixon. It's part of the American President series. And you can read an excerpt at our website, npr.org.